Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, welcome to another episode of New Books Network. My name is Roland Clark, and it's my pleasure to be speaking today to James Capello and Kinga Povedak about their new book, The Secret Police and the Religious Underground in Communist and Post-Communist Eastern Europe, which has recently appeared with Routledge. James is a senior lecturer in the study of religions at University College Cork in Ireland. He's the author of Text, Context and Performance, Gagauer's Folk Religion in Discourse and Practice, and most recently, Innocentism and Orthodox Christianity, Religious Dissent in the Russian and Romanian Borderlands. Kinga is a research fellow in the Convivence Religious Pluralism Research Group at the University of Szeged in Hungary. She's edited Dance, Age and Politics and is the author of a recent monograph on popular Christian music called Guitar Apostles. So James and Kinga, The Secret Police and Religious Underground brings together 16 different authors. How did you all get to know each other?
Yes, well, thank you very much. Some of the authors of this volume come from an ERC-funded project, which was headed by James. And the title of the project is Creative Agency and Religious Minorities, Hidden Galleries in the Secret Police Archives in Central and Eastern Europe. And this project has just ended earlier this year. And so a part of the authors for the volume were actually members of this project team. And towards the beginning of the project in 2017, we organized an international workshop in the Secret Police Archives in Budapest. In this workshop, which was it was entitled "Materializing Religion in the Secret Police Archive: Methodological, Ethical, and Legal Approaches to the Study of Religions in Secret Police Archives," and so in this workshop, it was our intention to include and to invite scholars from Central and Eastern Europe who already had kind of an expertise in researching religions through secret police archival materials, and who already had this this angle that their research could really contribute to the study of religion. So that was another addition to the group of authors. We included most of the workshop participants also in the book. And finally, then we invited some other researchers actually in the process of editing the volume in order to fill in what James and I found were kind of blind spots and needed to be somehow covered in the book. So eventually we ended up with this list of authors in the book that really covers a nice and diverse group of scholars. So we have contributions in this volume from historians, also from scholars of religions, but also from ethnographers and anthropologists.
Yeah, one of the things I really liked about it when I first picked it up was how interdisciplinary it is and how it jumps from one country to another and one time period to another, and it really draws together themes across a large region. But when I first saw the book, it's got this title, Religious Underground. And to me, the term religious underground made me think of people worshipping in temples or churches that they dug underground, which sounds a bit extreme. Did that really happen? What exactly was the religious underground?
Thanks, Roland. That's a really important question. And, of course, you know, it did happen. People dig. Literal underground spaces in which to worship and also to hide or to set up underground printing pressing. So there is a kind of literal dimension, if you like, to the underground in that sense. But it was much more than that. The term underground operated as a really powerful metaphor, a metaphor that was actually lived by for religious communities that experienced communist repression and also repression in the period before that. So, I mean, Christian history is littered with examples of such phenomena of underground spaces. And we only have to think about, you know, the idea of catacomb churches, for example. But we chose to use the term religious underground in the title because this metaphor, which had a material reality, was mobilized or put into effect by both sides in the Cold War. So the term itself goes back to the 1920s, early Soviet discourses, and one of the papers in the book deals with that. Tatiana Vagramenko talks about the reality effect of the discursive regime of truth that produced the idea of the religious underground and how that caused it to come into existence, in a sense. But it was also a powerful metaphor that was used in the West and was propagated through kind of Radio Free Europe and especially in American and UK propaganda during the Cold War that projected an idea of the religious underground as this valiant group of priests and pastors that evaded arrest that managed to combat the efforts of the Soviet regime and the later communist regimes to undermine religion. So this was really what captured our imagination in the book, that this the dialogical relationship, if you like, between the actions of the state, the repressive actions of the state, and the generation of this underground that was both a material reality, a spatial lived material reality for religious communities, but also this powerful metaphor that came into being and had to be lived by communities and shaped by powerful discourses on both sides of the Cold War.
As you just said, there's several actors, several types of actors in this book. There's religious people themselves, and then there's the secret policemen and the authorities who are investigating them all the time. But also in the book, there's a constant reference to files and archives left by the secret police. How is working with archives produced by secret police different to working with other types of archival sources?
That's an excellent question. There are some really important differences. The first one that we should really refer to is the idea that the secret police archives is essentially a hostile archive, that was generated in the very process of attempting to destroy the object of the archive, which was religion in society, religious communities. So in that sense, it's different from other archives. You know, it was not, even colonial archives, to a sense, would record a version of events that they wished to be preserved for posterity, on which history could be based. So often the virtuous activities of people in society and individuals and institutions get captured in archives, whereas the Secret Police Archives is an example of an archive of what the regime viewed to be unvirtuous or lacking in virtue, if you like. And the other important factor is, of course, that the Secret Police Archives were never intended to be viewed by anyone else other than the Secret Police themselves. So they have a very peculiar form that is introspective, in the sense that it was a discursive frame, a material frame that was for use by the Secret Police and by the Secret Police alone. Of course, the Secret Police communicated with other institutions, with other state bodies, and so the archive, you know, the traces of the archive extend out into the ministries and different state agencies and so on. But essentially, it was an archive for the Secret Police's own use and their own purposes. So it's you know, what we find in there, the evidential status, if you like, of what we find in there has this peculiar quality. And we always have to be very careful when looking at Secret Police archival sources to understand how they were generated, and what was masked in the creation of those files. But interestingly, for a scholar working today in the Secret Police Archives, what I think is probably one of the most important factors that make working in those archives different from others is the peculiarly powerful role that the archives play in contemporary society, in post-communist society, and in public discourse. So they were, the archives have been used for the processes of transitional justice, for lustration or vetting of people for public life, for some criminal cases against former communist leaders and so on, and for this whole process of kind of reckoning. One of the important things that happened in East Central Europe is that ordinary citizens were given access to their own personal files, and this is something peculiar in kind of global transitional justice kind of measures that should happen. And so the scholar working in those archives is kind of drawn into a set of powerful public discourses and ideas about truth and justice that perhaps make that endeavor different to working in an ordinary archive. So history writing, ethnography in the archive, anthropology in the archive is constantly in dialogue with this powerful public consciousness about the archive. Ideas that, you know, that were alive in communism. Sheila Fitzpatrick has written about this, that, the true biography of every individual is in the file. Their true life is in the file, rather than the life they actually lived or the life that they remember. That it's the perfect biography, and that, you know, anyone that was anyone would have a Secret Police file. So there's almost a sense that if you don't have one, you know, perhaps you're not as important as you thought you were. You know, so there's an investment in the potential or the idea that somehow the fullness of the truth of the period can be unearthed through the Secret Police Archive. And this is something that scholars working in the archives constantly deal with or struggle with. There's one other important thing I should mention in relation to the archives, which really is peculiar to the study of religions through the archives. You know, as scholars of religions, we're aware of the material dimension of religion, the important material dimension of religion, and also the performative quality of religion. And I think a number of the scholars in the book understood this and were able to draw on those archives as a powerful record of this dimension of religion, if you like. So the archives contain traces of the materiality of religion, and the reports and the informers' reports and agents' reports and so on also evoke the performativity of religion during communism. So we have a different quality altogether that a scholar of religion is trained to sort of pick up on, that you can discover in the files that we find in the archives. So there are a number of things there that really make the Secret Police Archives distinct, both from a general perspective for historians working in the archives, but especially for scholars of religion who are working through those sources.
And if I may add a little bit to this, because there is an important addition to make, that a number of studies in the volume really demonstrate the value of working from the archives, but really connecting the archival materials with the actual communities. So oftentimes there was this first archival research phase that James explained so well, working in the hostile archives. But then this first phase was actually followed by a second phase when we approached those religious communities whose materials appeared in the archives. And it was our aim and our goal to conduct some ethnographic work with them. So during the course of this ethnographic research, which followed the archival phase, we contacted these religious communities in order to discuss their presence in the secret police archives and to talk about all the images and all the texts that we have found in the archives. So in a way, we worked from the archives, but then actually arrived to the field, to the so-called field. So this connection with the communities through their visual materials from the secret police archives was really a methodologically critical part of the research behind some of the chapters of the volume.
Thanks, Kinga. I'm really glad that you mentioned images as well as texts, because your chapter in the volume looks at photographs that you found in the archive. Can you tell us a little bit about reading photographs? What can photographs tell us that we can't get out of written texts?
Yes. Thank you for this question. Yes. So, we have come across actually a lot of photographs in the secret police archives that that were related to religions in some ways, and we try to approach these photographs with this question in mind, that can we use these images somehow going beyond serving as simple illustrations? And we tried to really ask whether these photographs that were intended to capture reality, but from a very specific ideological perspective. So, asking these questions, are these photographs at all capable of opening up new layers of the past? So in my chapter for the book, I worked on doing interviews with the so-called photo elicitation technique. And this technique has not really been used in religious studies very often or very much, but I could find that so much of the benefits of this photo elicitation method added to the actual interview process. And so when I was using photo elicitation, the purpose was not really to refute these agent reports, but somehow to produce kind of counter narratives a narrative which is in a way liberated from the confines of the file. And so I use these photographic images as a way to invoke and to elicit these new kinds of liberated narratives. And well, one of the important benefits of photo elicitation I found was that, you know, working with these photographs really encouraged a different insight into finding out stories. So not just, you know, more in-depth insights, but these insights were different. So I could feel how photographs really encouraged talk that was about different things, issues or topics that I haven't even thought about asking in the process. And well, another huge benefit that I could observe throughout this photo elicitation process was that by looking at these photographs, I could get an immediate point of access to the memories of my interviewees. So by looking at the images, somehow they you know, memories and elements of memory instantly came back. And so through that process, I have learned many new information. And of course, another important feature of the photo elicitation interviews was that it really encouraged a certain type of talk that was more emotional and more effective in a way. So, and this aspect I found crucial, because when working with secret police materials, which is, well, needless to point out, but by its nature quite problematic, quite emotional. So with using the photo elicitation method, I really appreciated how these affective memories and emotions came up. And of course, you know, the actually working through the photos enabled kind of a collaborative working relationship with the interviewees, which again, you know, regarding the sensitive material in secret police files, it was particularly important that somehow this research participant, this power dynamic between the interviewer and an interviewee, the researcher participant power dynamic was kind of shifted in a way. So I found these elements of using images from the secret police files quite useful. But then, you know, through the re-engagement with these lost images, because in most cases we talk about lost images, right? Because these images or these photographs were not known by the actual community. And so by re-engaging with these lost images, photo elicitation could help and ensure that that really the research, when connecting with these communities, was not really only about loss and not really only about reliving the experience of persecution, but it somehow we could turn and shift the dynamics of the interviews into empowerment, into renewal, into contestation. So I found that especially useful in that sense. And of course, what is the value of these images? So of course, it's obvious that these images from the secret police archives offer us invaluable snapshots because they portray and they really document and tell us about, in a visual way, about really hidden forms of religious practices that we had, you know, really no idea. And well, these photographs were actually all either confiscated or created by the secret police, and they eventually were used in the anti-religious operations. So if we really think about it, these images really have this duality in them. So they contain this dual character in a way, because on the one hand, they were used by the secret police, and they were used as incriminating evidence against those religious communities. But on the other hand, they also, in a way, represent the memories and the cultural patrimonies of these religious groups. So in that way, this duality of these images are really interesting. If I may add, I think I would like to call attention to the photographs in that, because they really played a central part in the Hidden Galleries research project that I have mentioned earlier. And I would call attention to the digital archives, which was one of the outputs of the project. And well, we have created this digital archive in order to feature all kinds of visual materials. So there are examples for crime scene photographs. There are examples for surveillance photographs, but there are also images of confiscated religious materials and confiscated photographs of religious communities of their or images of their religious leaders, or we have images of brochures, song books, prayer books, icons, drawings, letters. So all of these are featured in the digital archives, which is really designed to demonstrate the kinds of materials that were produced by, but also about, the religious underground, and really just pointing to what are the types of materials that can be found in secret police archives concerning religion. So it was really really a way providing examples for, you know, what kind of visual materials can be found in secret police archives, well, for scholars, but also for faith communities that do not necessarily research in secret police archives. So it was our way of pointing to the richness of the secret police archives, and, well, therefore the name of the project, of course, Hidden Galleries.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I love your digital archive. It's now my go-to place for every time I'm putting together a conference presentation on interwar Romanian religion. If I need to find some pictures to put up on the screen, it's an amazing treasure trove there. And you guys put together a book as well called Hidden Galleries, Material Religion in the Secret Police Archives in Central and Eastern Europe, which is more of a coffee table book and has some beautiful pictures from that archive, from the digital archive as well. But what your comment on photo solicitation reminded me of was that you guys are really, both of you, are anthropologists at heart. And so I, as a historian, when I come to these archives, I'm interested in something that is dead, is finished. Most of these case studies focus on religious movements under state socialism, and state socialism collapsed 30 years ago. Is this just an antiquarian study of the past, or does understanding the religious underground have relevance for the present, like for today as well?
Thanks, Roland. Both Kinga and I are kind of ethnographers, anthropologists, but also historians of religion. But the point you make is a really important one, and I think what Kinga was saying there about photo elicitation with contemporary communities puts a finger on it. Anthropologists of religion have been interested in questions of the dynamics of kind of religious change, transmission of religion, schism within religion, secrecy practices. These are all kind of general themes that flow through the anthropology of religion and the anthropology of Christianities in particular. And so, of course, when we look back at the history of these communities, we're also concerned with understanding how that shaped the present. Some quite eminent anthropologists of Christianity in Eastern Europe, people like Chris Hahn and Douglas Rogers, have pointed to the fact that, you know, we can't really understand the dynamics of contemporary, the place of religion in contemporary society in the former Soviet republics or in Eastern Europe, unless we understand the nature of the position of religion during communism, and especially how religion was transmitted during that time. So we're really picking up on some universal themes there. The other critical dimension, as I said, you know, any kind of research in the secret police archives is political because of the political nature of the archives in post-communism. And the authors in the book and the project team members, and I think I speak probably for all of them, have a critical awareness of the ongoing marginalization processes and prejudice in society against religious others. And so the process of using secret police archives, using material religion in the archives, photographic elicitation techniques and using those photographic sources. We also staged public exhibitions doing ethnography with communities in a kind of participatory research process. It's about the present. It's about how the political environment, the religious field, democratic and open societies function. So even though I wouldn't say we're really doing advocacy scholarship, far from it, but certainly it's engaged scholarship in the sense that we understand the impact that historical research and understanding the past has on the shaping of contemporary public sphere.
Thanks, James. That makes a lot of sense. And of course, all of the movements in this book are persecuted religious movements. What happens to religious groups when you persecute them? Are there patterns to how people respond to persecution?
Well, thank you for that question. Yes, so of course there is a broader sociological literature on persecution and persecution of in new religious movements in particular, both in the past, both in current times, and of course looking at how they are seen, how they are understood, how they are handled by society. But we don't really look at these patterns of persecution sociologically. But if I should mention a few patterns or tendencies, if you like, one of them would certainly be the creation of new and creative responses that came with being underground or that came with being hidden religious groups, and the ways in which persecution has put them in a position that there was an essential need for coming up with new practices in order to survive. So if you think about it, just by creating the actual underground, which, you know, as it was discussed earlier, it is not necessarily underground, but by actually creating those safe spaces, it required a great deal of creativity. And, you know, like, for instance, while, you know, some communities actually went underground, they housed services in cellars, but then other communities, for instance, in Hungary, they have found these similar safe spaces by escaping to nature, for instance. So they were organizing excursions, and these excursions were actually, small trips, and these were actually like covert ways of doing spiritual days or prayer groups, for instance, and that was their way of really avoiding the eye of the authorities. Or another example, if we think about the lack of printing houses, and just think about the ways how these communities had to find solutions for really producing and spreading songs books, prayer books. And that has led to the creation of religious samizdat materials. So, or for instance, when they were communicating about the underground services or religious matters, we find examples when a community, so for instance, in this case, the Jehovah Witnesses community in Soviet Ukraine, they have developed a coded language, actually, to communicate with each other and to communicate with their religious center. So you see how this aspect of creative agency that was created due to the repression and due to the persecution of religions, And well, we found this very fascinating topic. So we are trying to bring these practices into the center of our research. But I should also mention that there has been instances, and in one case I personally experienced this, when repression and surveillance of the secret police left something of a lingering distrust in a community that was under persecution. And so this distrust, generally in the institutions and in the authorities, but this distrust was also expressed towards me as a researcher who wanted to enter and engage in an ethnographic research with them. So a group which has been forced underground by the secret police surveillance, and then because of that, they had become quite secretive in their ways, but they remained quite secretive after 1989 as well. So the group was not open to any collaboration with me as a researcher. So we can only presume that this lingering loss of trust, and then the fact that their secretive practices remained, it just kind of, it's a coping mechanism. But this is also, I think, a very important pattern, if you like, that we need to consider when looking and dealing with the legacies of persecution, I think.
That's really interesting. The past is certainly not dead. In fact, it's still very much alive in some places. James, you mentioned material religion before. What about food? How did you find that in the archives? How did state socialist persecution change the way that food functioned in religious practices of these communities?
Very much so, Roland. I'd say that food is kind of ubiquitously present there in many files, because part of the history of communism, part of the history of the Soviet regime and socialism, was about lack of resources, lack of food, famine, collectivization. So in the whole history of 20th century communism, the relationship between the communist state's desire to generate abundance, but its inability and the production of a lack of things, meant that attention often turned to food. My own chapter in the book deals with a case from 1950s and 1960s, Romania, Romania had experienced in the immediate post-war years food shortages and famine, and then there was a collectivization campaign which exacerbated the situation, rapid urbanization which changed the patterns of consumption and food production. So in this context, which was not unique to Romania at all, the secret police paid particular attention to the ways that food was present within religious communities, because again, we come to kind of general ideas about the relationship between, the peasantry, the wealthy peasantry, kulaks, and the association with resistance to collectivization, accusations of sabotage of the state. Religious communities were very much seen in as part of this kind of total picture of the enemy. The enemy is both kulak, is religious reactionary, is politically right-wing, and so on. When there was this intense focus on the need for food production and the state's control of food production, that's present in the archives, and we see that religious communities themselves had an interest in ensuring that they had enough food for the community. They would share those foodstuffs. They would practice a slightly more egalitarian or communitarian approach to wealth and so on. So in the chapter, my chapter in the book deals with a religious community that as part of their practices to maintain their religious network, gathered foodstuffs, special foodstuffs that were needed during the long fasting periods that they engaged in. Those foodstuffs were, transactional gifts, if you like, with the spiritual elders of the community, and they held the community together in a certain sense. But they were also able to use those foodstuffs against their oppressor, against the enemy. They had a very dualistic and apocalyptic mindset. So the idea was that the foodstuffs that were brought in to the community could be blessed and then redistributed secretly in society to subvert the activities of the secret police or the authorities. And so one of the very interesting practices they had was blessing of foodstuffs by the spiritual fathers that would then be secretly given to the wives of acting officers or Communist Party members, with the hope of using them as a kind of spiritual weapon of the weak against their oppressors. But this is a really fascinating theme that I think there's a lot of potential still in the secret police archives to explore this whole dynamic around food, and even beyond food into general, the lack of or abundance of the lack of products in the West, in the East, and the abundance of products in the West, and the sacred meanings that those became imbued with during communism.
I really love that idea of blessing your enemy and giving your persecutor blessed food as a gift, as a weapon of the weak. It's beautiful. So you keep talking about religious communities, but the vast majority of movements in this book, and there's a lot of different movements, but most of them are some sort of Christian. Kinga, can you tell us a bit about the non-Christian groups that the book deals with?
Yes, that's a very good question. Why we cover almost only Christian groups in the volume, and that's, that makes me think as well. But of course, one answer would be, because in Central and Eastern Europe, I think Christianity was seen as the main ideological enemy for communism, and so. Because Christianity influenced the thinking of most people. But naturally, of course, we shouldn't say that other religious communities were not under surveillance as well. So in the book, actually, we offer a non-Christian example from Lithuania, where Rasa Pranskevičiūtė talks about the Hare Krishna devotees, and she talks about how this Hare Krishna movement was received in Soviet Lithuania, and how some of the devotees and how some of the leaders of the movement, of the Hare Krishna movement, were actually put into psychiatric hospitals, and they had to endure extreme treatments and so on.
Yeah, and one of the poison chalices of editing a collected volume is that you can never include everything that you want, because even if you do, the publisher comes back to you and says, well, you've got to cut out 100,000 words of your book. And I really enjoyed that Hare Krishna chapter. It was fascinating stuff. A lot's been written. Of course, this is not the first book on secret police under state socialism. And we have books on the Securitate in Romania, to the NKVD in Russia, the Stasi, the AVH, the STB, the Saugumas, and the SB. What does studying the repression of religious movements tell us that other studies of secret police in general don't tell us? Like, what's special about looking at religious groups and their relationship to the repressive organs of state socialism?
Thanks, Roland. Yes. I would say first and foremost, in relation to the book, it was never really intended to be a book about the secret police independently of the other object of study. So our primary focus really is this dialectic between the secret police and our religious communities and the religious underground. So the relationship between repressive power and creative agency. I think we're probably one of the first books, the only book I can think of, that actually tries to do that. So it's not a systematic study of the secret police or even a comparative exercise in understanding the kind of repressive methods and structures of the secret police. What it does do is unpack multiple examples of the way that the secret police interfaced with, influenced, and shaped religion. Whether that's from mass deportations to, you know, agent infiltration. And so the real contribution of the book is in that generative space between those two phenomena, or that came into being because of that relationship between religion and the secret police. So unlike perhaps other books that focus on the secret police and the impact of the secret police, we have tried to steer away from focusing on the destructive dimension, on questions of victimhood, and instead look more closely at some of the things we've already talked about today, the creativity, kind of the generation of diverse responses, the kind of reshaping of the religious landscape in that point of contact. So one of the chapters that I think in the book deals with this very well, by our Czech colleague, Andrei Mateka, on the Czech Protestant Church, is that he really explores the way that the secret police used their own experience of their operations against a community to generate instruction manuals and kind of education materials for the secret police, but that this material that they were generating and then using to train officers and to inform agents that were engaging with religion in Czech Republic had the power to ultimately to reshape the religious community's own self understanding of what they went through during the communist era, to such an extent that, you know, in the contemporary Czech Protestant Church, Andre talks about a real generational split between the understanding of what happened during communism, one of which is based on the image that the secret police produced of the church, which was one of dangerous resistance to communism, whereas the younger generation, which is more open perhaps to critical historical research and questioning the past, sees that actually the church's history, as historians can reveal it, was one of compromise and engagement with the communist regime. So that chapter really reveals to us the power that secret police had unintentionally, because the intention was in the creation of the image of the dangerous church and dangerous actors within the church, was to eliminate the church altogether. Actually has became a motor for producing a self-image that with the idea of kind of a heroism within the church and a martyrdom within the church that has proved to be a powerful factor in the church today. So it's really an exercise. The book is an exercise in engaging scholars that are specialists on the secret police with scholars who are specialists in the study of religions, and seeing what emerges in that fertile kind of space when we examine the historical record.
So you're taking scholars of the secret police and you're putting them into conversation with scholars of religion, but you're also putting all those people together in conversation with each other across national boundaries. This is very much a comparative volume. So you guys have case studies on Ukraine and Moldova, Lithuania, Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia. I don't think I've missed any, but I probably have. So there's a lot of similarities here in that every one of these places, you've got secret policemen investigating underground religious movements. But what about the differences? Are there any that stand out? What did you learn by putting all of these stories side by side into one sort of between two covers?
Yes, thank you, Roland. So as you say, the similarities are, of course, quite obvious. And well, that's primarily because of the, you know, having this ideological background that created this anti-religious repression. But of course, the cases and the chapters present, you know, a certain dissimilarity. Well, one that really strikes is, for instance, in the timeline of the religious repressions. And basically, in that sense, if we think about the timeline of religious repressions, basically all countries differ from one another, so all chapters in that sense. But also, there are, of course, differences in the harshness and in the measures of persecutions as well, and well, also these differences derive from the actual differences that are within church-state relations, of course, and then the ways the churches are handling. Or the churches were handled by the state, and then the differences in the ways these measures were implemented by the secret police. So once we look at countries with a single majority church like Poland or Romania, and then oppose them with countries with a more diverse religious field, like Czechoslovakia or Hungary. So these differences become evident there again. And then, of course, the differences also lie in the originally different religious makeup of these countries and the ways in which this somehow contributed to the different church-state relations. I think that's also quite important. So just to mention a case, for instance, a chapter written by Maciej Krzysztof in Poland, which is not a diverse context religiously, but it is well demonstrated in Maciej's contribution how these popular ways of religion, popular ways of Catholicism, such as Marian visions, for instance, become really salient ways to respond to this repression. And of course, such cases are doesn't really appear in a different context, for instance. And then, well, another difference that might come into mind is the ways how religious repression and how religious persecution is remembered and how it's dealt with. So, for instance, we have two chapters from Romania. So Juliana Cindrea and Christian Vasile. And both of these articles to some degree address, you know, how the politics of memory might arise from a church claim. And in their respective chapters, they touch upon issues on how in Romania the Orthodox Church they talk about the Orthodox Church's attempts to be seen as, you know, the sole victim of communism, and really by emphasizing these narratives of self-victimization. I think that's important. So, I mean, there are certainly different differences also in the ways and really to the degrees to which religious persecution is instrumentalized in memory politics as well. So, I mean, there are many, many differences, of course, in the book as well.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kinga. And thank you both of you for taking the time to talk us through what's in the book and some of the issues surrounding it. I think if people want to find out more, they can go and read the book, but we should probably leave it there for today. So thank you very much, both of you. And I feel like I need to pick the book up again and have a look at it.
Thanks very much, Roland.
Thank you, Roland. Thank you.